The U.S. Senate is hoping to approve bipartisan immigration reform within months. Today, two Republican members of Iowa's congressional delegation with their views on immigration and many other issues. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, my guest is Iowa Senator Charles Grassley. Then, in the second half hour, Congressman Steve King of Iowa's 4th District. We'll get their reaction to the new Senate agreement, which would shore up America's borders and provide an eventual path to citizenship for undocumented workers. Also, their priorities for the new session of Congress and their views on other hot-button issues we're facing. We start right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today on the program, two Republican members of Iowa's congressional delegation to Washington with their views on the, for instance, the bipartisan immigration agreement reached yesterday in the Senate. Many other issues, we hope. We hope you'll join in our conversation. Joining us in this first half hour, U.S. Senator Charles Grassley, live from Washington. Senator Grassley, welcome back to our program.
Hey, Ben, I think I've been on your program a couple times before, and I enjoy it very much. Thank you for asking me back.
We're delighted to have you, Senator, and we want to invite our listeners to join us with your questions for Senator Grassley. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, and we're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Senator Grassley with us for this first half hour, then Congressman Steve King joining us for the second half hour. If we could, Senator, let's start with immigration. After years of inaction, immigration policy changing suddenly, it seems, with a notable momentum there in Washington today. President Obama addressing the issue in Las Vegas in a speech yesterday, that bipartisan group of senators outlining their ideas for a bill that could move through the chamber, they say, as early as spring. Now, we know the most difficult part of any immigration, comprehensive immigration reform, would be that path to citizenship, if there would be one, for those who came here, have come here illegally. We call them undocumented workers. On that very point, what sort of path would you support for that 10 or 12 million who are here?
First of all, you mentioned an outline, so we're talking about ideas that people have put on paper, and there's no bill, and there's a lot of holes and vacant spots that's got to be filled in this outline. Now, to answer your question about path to citizenship, I voted for a path to citizenship in 1986, and we thought we constructed a very, very tight piece of legislation that would make sure that people didn't continue to come into this country. And I voted for it. 3 million people were here at that time that we legalized, and they, I suppose most of them eventually became citizens if they wanted to. We found out that later on what we did didn't help at all, and now instead of having 3 million undocumented people in the country, we have 11 or 12 million people undocumented in the country. So I'm not specifically asking your question what I would vote for, but I want to lay a lesson from history. And in the last sentence of the preamble of the paper that was put out yesterday by the 18 senators, there's something along this line. I'm paraphrasing.
Okay.
We want to write a bill that will make sure that we never have to deal with this problem in the future. That's exactly what we tried to do in 1986, so I think it's a little naive, and I speak from experience, to think that you're going to solve this problem once and for all.
Oh.
I would say what I could vote for would be the extent to which a provision of this idea that citizenship doesn't kick in until we have certified that the border is secure and people can't willy-nilly come into this country illegally. Now, that determination is going to be made after we pass a piece of legislation, and there's going to be a commission set up that will determine, yes, the border's secure. And then at that point, people can move to citizenship.
Mm-hmm. Back to the point of the path, and you pointed out that what you see as a historical lesson there. Would you rule out then a path for citizenship based on that failed attempt that you voted for in the 80s?
I think it'd be easier if the border is really secure. That would be and then the answer to your question is when I and I'll be a part of putting this legislation together. Even though I'm not a sponsor of this outline that was put out there, because writing legislation is more difficult than just an outline. But anyway, I want to see what that language is that guarantees the border is going to be secured, and that would have a determination of whether or not I would vote for this path to citizenship. Now, on the other hand, you got to face the reality, because there's some people in this country, and I'm not one of them, that think that we can round up 11 million people and ship them out of the country. That's unreal. I want people to know that I know that. I want people to know that I support legislation in the past that allows 900,000 to a million people to come here every year legally. And I want people to know that even from people that are undocumented, I've watched them enough that I think we can still continue to learn from them like we have nine generations of people that have come to this country from other countries. You know, most of them are very religious people, family-oriented, and a very good work ethic. And quite frankly, we people that were born here or recently moved here can learn a lot. Then I'll stop with this. I gave an admonition to a citizenship group that I spoke to in Cedar Rapids the day they were made citizens of the United States, and I gave a long speech, but at the end of it I said, will you do me a favor? You are coming from all different backgrounds into our country, and you're probably going to appreciate America more than those of us who's born here, our freedoms and liberties. So when you hear some American complain about America, that American being born here, and you come from a different society, and you appreciate the freedoms and liberties that we don't appreciate as much as we should, I hope you'll call them on it.
Okay. One follow-up on this, Senator Grassley. President Obama is owing his reelection victory in large part to Hispanics, who gave him 71% of their vote in November, according to exit polls. And since then, I'm sure you've heard the conventional wisdom in the media that the GOP needs to soften its stance on immigration. So is this it? Are we now seeing that softening, that sea change in the GOP, in your party, with its thinking on immigration?
Yeah, very definitely. At least that's why this is moving through in a bipartisan way at this point. Now, you know, it moved the same way in 2005 or 6 after President Bush campaigned on this point and pushed for it probably at least as hard as President Obama is. And it fell through. And I suppose if this isn't handled right, it could be followed through again. But I think we Republicans have to realize that just passing an immigration bill is not going to solve our problems with some minority groups, particularly the Hispanics. What I think that we haven't done enough of is just outreach and have contact. Because, as I said, they have family values, they have religious values, they have work ethics, things that in other words, I'm trying to say that most of these people that come here are fairly conservative people, at least in their social outlook. And we Republicans can probably appeal to them more on those points than we can on immigration, even if we do a very good job on immigration. And I think that that's the problem we have, and I don't think we should be so naive to think that we just pass an immigration bill that we're going to start getting 40 or 50% of the Hispanic vote. We've got to do a lot more than that, and most of it is to talk to them.
Erica joins us via Twitter with this question, Senator Grassley. As a former teacher in a rural Iowa town with lots of immigrants, Erica wants to know, how can we make it possible for students to go to college? I'm guessing she's thinking about young people of undocumented workers, if you interpret that the same way I do.
I think, yes. And these are people that are—they may have been brought here illegally— But they've lived their entire life here, particularly if they came as newborns, and then they've been around 10 years. They don't know some other country like they know the United States. And I think that this is going to be a very much included in this bill, but I don't know whether it's going to go a lot further than what the president did on his administrative action. And his administrative action is a fact of life. So that's kind of behind us, whether we legislate in that area or not. But I'm sure we will legislate in that area because there's probably some holes that the president didn't include in his administrative action.
Senator Grassley with us for this first half hour live from Washington. If you'd like to join our conversation with a question, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Your colleague, longtime Senate colleague Tom Harkin, has announced he will not seek another term in Congress. You have said, you and Senator, we were doing some numbers on this, Senator Grassley. You've served in the Senate since 1981. Senator Harkin since 1985. Together you have served as Iowa senators for nearly 30 years. We counted up the days even, 21,925 days, something like that. Over 60 years of service together. Counting together, amounting to more side-by-side experience than any other state's current senatorial delegation. What stands out for you most about your work together for Iowa in this Senate?
Well, first of all, you know, people outside of Iowa, nobody in Iowa asked me this much, but outside of Iowa, they say, how can Iowans elect a conservative like you and a liberal like Harkin? And I don't really have an answer, but my suppos, and I tell them that. It's difficult to explain. But I tell them I think Iowans are, if you're doing a good job, even if they don't agree with you, they're apt to vote for you if they think you're sincere and working hard and haven't forgotten Iowa. And I think that applies to both Tom Harkin and me. I was really surprised by his announcement. I saw an article in the paper where he was having a fundraiser here or there, and hasn't changed what he's done over the last 28 years in the Senate. Pretty much stayed the same. He and I vote differently, but when it comes to Iowa, whether it's a flood year or whether it's some other project for Iowa or whether it's agriculture, particularly in those areas, we've had a very good working relationship. And, you know, I can't recall, and I wouldn't say sometime he hasn't attacked me, and I don't want to say sometime I haven't attacked him. But, you know, if it's been at all, it's been so infrequent, I couldn't even tell you the last time he and I had a disagreement. So we've gotten along very well, even if we don't vote the same on national issues. But when it comes to Iowa, Iowa's first for both of us, and we work together. And I don't think anybody's going to dispute that. And I'm kind of surprised at his retirement. I accept it. He gave me a personal call on Saturday afternoon after he made the announcement, said he wanted me to know. And, you know, I said to him, when I first heard it, my inclination was that I ought to call you. And then I said, you know, it might look like somebody's gloating about it. So I said, you really broke the ice when you called me. And I said, I thank you for calling me, and I'm glad we're having this conversation.
Charles Grassley, you will turn 80 this year, I believe, in September, I think. You have said already you will not decide whether you will run again in 2016. That would be the next time. You won't until a year or a year and a half before that 2016 election. When you think about your own retirement, what are the key factors that will go into that decision 2016?
Well, number one, does my wife say it's okay to run? Number two, can I look ahead 6 years and see, can I finish a term? That's very important. If I can, you know, if I can still run 4 mornings a week, 3 miles each time, you know, that's some indication I'm pretty good healthy, and I do that right now, and I intend to continue to do it. But I'm not thinking a whole lot about beyond 2016 until probably I get to 2015 or late 2014, because we got so many problems right here now. But I have to confess to you, I'm doing a lot of things that you'd normally do if you were running for re-election. You're working for your political party. I mean, in Iowa, a attending events, stuff like that. I'm raising money. I'm trying to let people know that what I believe in and things like that. And so that's where my concentration is now. But you've described it right, that I'll be making up my mind then. And it'll be a personal decision. But I also have to think in terms of being third in seniority in the Republican Party now, sixth in the United States Senate, and particularly with Senator Harkin retiring. If seniority helps Iowa, I ought to continue to serve. But meanwhile, my goals are to continue what I think I'm famous for, government oversight, to make sure that the executive branch, Republican or Democrat, faithfully execute the laws and to use a common-sense approach to problem-solving for Iowans and for the country.
Senator Grassley, yesterday the president met with law enforcement officials from communities affected by the horrible high-profile shootings we've had in recent years. He stressed the importance of reaching consensus with Congress to advance his gun violence proposals, and he ticked off a number of the items on that list, including what he called serious laws that restrict the access and availability of assault weapons, magazine clips that aren't necessary for hunters and sportsmen, universal background checks, also mentioned issues of mental health and school safety. I'm wondering, as you look down that list, what, if any, proposals by the president about gun violence could you support?
Well, for sure, any improvement of mental health determination. So what happened in Aurora, Colorado, where the psychologist or psychiatrist was working with the person that did the bad deeds out there, didn't report anything to the data bank in Washington. The extent to which felons are not reported by the states the way they should be. In other words, we ought to have a foolproof data bank of who can buy guns and who can't buy guns. And obviously felons can today, but if they aren't reported to the database, they can, and not all of them are reported. In fact, you know, just a handful of states have reported all, and they make up the highest percentage of the 1.5 million people, or no, a few million people that are in that database. But we got to do a better job on mental health.
We've had a couple of psychiatrists, really, really people who've dedicated their careers to studying mental health and mental illness, and the consensus seems to be it's next to impossible to predict someone with mental illness taking an act such as we've seen at the elementary school. And so beforehand, afterwards, you can say you saw it coming, but beforehand, it's very difficult.
Well, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm going to have to rely on that judgment of those people. I'll have to study it. I'm sure there's other psychiatrists have other points of view. I'm not disputing the ones you're quoting. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that we have a problem with mental health because in the Arizona shooting, in the Aurora, Colorado shooting, and in the Newtown shooting, it's very obvious. It's very obvious.
An email from Kathy for you, Senator Kathy in LeClaire. I would like a yes or no answer from Senator Grassley as to whether he will support a ban on semi-automatic combat-style guns and large-capacity ammunition clips.
No, and I voted that way in the past.
Your reasoning?
My reasoning is that based upon statistics from 1994 through 2004, it hasn't done anything to stop it. And semi-automatic long guns, like they're talking about banning, are not any more of a problem than semi-automatic pistols, or they wouldn't do, or you could do as much damage with a semi-automatic shotgun, and they're not affected. And mostly because guns don't kill people, people kill people, and also because of the Second Amendment right to bear arms. That's has been part of the Constitution for 225 years, but backed up by very strong Supreme Court decisions, a couple in the last 3 or 4 years, that very much back it up as a personal right and defending that right.
And finally, Senator Grassley, before we have to say goodbye, you've always said that you supported the definition of marriage as between one man and one woman. Now, we've seen some high-profile Republicans saying it's time to stop fighting against same-sex marriage. Yesterday, I'm sure you caught wind of a gathering in Iowa. David Koshel, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney's Iowa campaign advisor, he says his support for same-sex marriage is an extension of his conservatism. Another, Ken Mellman, who engineered George W. Bush's successful 2004 reelection campaign, spoke in favor of that, too. I wonder, are you rethinking your position at all on same-sex marriage? Because some conservatives argue it does fit in with conservative ideas about freedom. Why not be free to marry any person you love?
Yeah. I think for a historical reason, marriage has always been considered by our societies and many other societies other than Iowa for thousands of years as being between a man and a woman. I don't have any objection to the lifestyle of anybody else. I do resent being called homophobic when I don't support same-sex marriages because I don't hate anybody. I want to emphasize that. I don't hate anybody. In fact, my religion requires me not to hate anybody else. I'm supposed to love. That's the basis of my religion. Agape love, to have an intense, that's Greek, to have an intense interest in the welfare of your fellow man and woman. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I hope that marriage stays within state law, and I hope the Supreme Court doesn't nationalize it or federalize it, so that then there will be movements in Congress to do it, so that I would have to make such a decision, because I believe that the diversity of America, and I'm talking about because we're so geographically diverse, our society's so diverse, I think it's very difficult to make law in Washington and have it cover the entire country. And I think the changes that have gone on over 40 years in people's feelings towards abortion have proven that it would be better off if that were a legislative decision made in the various states than it is one made in Washington. So I'm hoping that the courts don't federalize this and that we can keep this at the state level. So if Iowa wants to have same-sex marriage, they can have it. But if South Carolina or North Carolina recently voted, they don't want to have it, then they don't have to have it.
Okay, very quickly, Republicans gathering in North Carolina for the RNC's winter meeting, debating how best to bounce back from the election where your party lost the White House for a second time in a row, lost seats in the House, lost seats in the Senate. What is your remedy for the GOP? And sorry, Senator, we have about 30 or 40 seconds.
Well, my remedy is that we have to consider the best policy is the best politics. Beyond that, we have to learn to communicate with people that we felt we never had to communicate with. That could be African Americans. It could be Hispanic people. It could be Asian Americans. It could be even people that are European white that maybe we haven't spent enough time talking to. We got to be more outreaching.
U.S. Senator Charles Grassley, we do appreciate you talking to us for this half hour. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll be joined live by U.S. Congressman Steve King of Iowa's 4th District to talk about some of the same issues and some other issues. If you'd like to have your question aired for Congressman Steve King, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. Back live with U.S. Congressman Steve King after this short break. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour we've been talking to two Republican members of Iowa's congressional delegation in Washington with their views on immigration and some other issues. We'd like to have you join our conversation as Congressman Steve King of Iowa's 4th District joins us for this half hour, elected to Iowa's new 4th District in November, beating former First Lady Kristi Vilsack. And Steve King, remind you, a leading member of the Tea Party caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives. Representative King, thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it a great deal, Ben.
Let me throw out that number for our listeners for any questions for Congressman King, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's talk about what seems to be the biggest story at the moment, the immigration story. Immigration policy suddenly changing, it seems, with momentum in Washington. President Obama, in a speech in Las Vegas yesterday, that bipartisan group of senators outlining their ideas for a bill that could move through the chamber with comprehensive immigration reform as early as spring. Congressman King, a couple of weeks ago, you introduced a bill that would deny birthright citizenship to the children of some immigrant parents. Are you swimming against the tide? Do you feel that?
Well, you know, to some degree, there were some Republicans that woke up the morning after the election and decided that they would determine that Mitt Romney would be president if we had just passed some legislation that would legalize people that are unlawfully present in the United States. As the data unfolded, I think they realize now that that was a hasty conclusion for them to draw. I don't know that I'm swimming against the tide. What I'm doing is standing with the rest of the countries in the world, the Constitution and the rule of law. And I think it's important to remember that there are between 340,000 and 750,000 babies born in this country to, well, actually both parents, unlawfully present. And that there's a tourism industry that's been built up where they are selling round-trip tickets to bring people in from places in the world to have a baby, give them the birth certificate, and then as they reach age, they start the family reunification process. We can do a lot better. The Constitution says that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are American citizens. That phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, is in there for a reason, and we've embarked upon a long practice of granting automatic citizenship. And most people in this country agree with me on the birthright citizenship issue.
Mm-hmm. But you're referring, I believe, to the 14th Amendment, that clause that you're saying there. Could you see your concerns, specifically what you're saying with the people flying in to have kids here on our soil, couldn't that be somehow integrated into a comprehensive immigration reform?
Well, that would be nice if it could be. I suspect that the eight senators that made their announcement yesterday aren't open to that suggestion. It'd be nice if it could be. And there are a number of other things that we could do to improve our immigration policy. You know, the citizens of the United States, speaking through their elected representatives, should be making the determination on who comes into America and who can become an American citizen. And American citizenship should be precious. It shouldn't be dealt out to anybody that can come into America unlawfully and have a baby. And that's really the bottom line of it. Not just, you know, the language of the 14th Amendment, again, is all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. And so that's the principle. It would be litigated, I'm confident. Immigration issues constantly are. But in the end, the Constitution means what it says, and it has the clause and subject to the jurisdiction thereof for a reason. And most people that read this that disagree with me on the policy say that it hasn't, that particular clause has no meaning.
Let's, if we could, talk about what is the crux of the matter in this immigration debate, the $10 to $12 million undocumented workers, those who came to this country illegally and have become a big part of our economy. Could you see yourself supporting any path towards citizenship for these people?
Well, I just think to lead with that is that's the thing we need to finish up with. Rather than lead with a path to citizenship, we need to first to get the rule of law established. And you're not going to get that by passing a bill. You have to actually have to enforce the laws.
I think they're talking about border integrity and also dealing with those who have lawfully applied to immigrate. I think that's part of the comprehensive bill. If these concerns were taken care of, could you imagine a path that you could support for these 10 or 12 million undocumented workers?
My point is that you can't take care of a lack of law enforcement by passing another bill that promises to enforce the law. I remember the 86 Amnesty Act that was signed by Ronald Reagan, and they were straight about it. They said, this is an amnesty bill, but we're going to make sure that we never do this again and we will enforce our immigration laws. And, of course, they've gotten ever more lax since 86. And I don't know how anyone could expect the president to enforce any promise of new enforcement when he hasn't actually respected his oath to the Constitution itself with regard to immigration. He's decided that he can create it by executive edict, and the Constitution never contemplated a president that would have that level of boldness to do that. So I just think it's going to be hard to do business with this president. I'd like to see him go out and demonstrate they're going to enforce the law. We need to get to the point at some point where we deal with the people that are here unlawfully. But until we get the foundation in place of border control rather than a promise for it and enforcement of our existing laws, then to wrap it up in a package and try to sell a promise of enforcement with a path to citizenship isn't going to work now any better than it did in 2006 and 7, and it's not going to be any better solution than it was in 1986.
U.S. Congressman Steve King of Iowa's 4th District joining us live for this half hour. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook. You can send us a post there or tweet us at IPR Talk. Lisa joining us from Waterloo. Hi, Lisa. You have a question about immigration?
I sure do. Thanks. Congressman King, I was just wondering, I actually have a million questions I'd like to ask you, but I'll put out two. My experience has been working with the immigrant community for about 15 years in Iowa, that a lot of times people make assumptions about the immigration process or immigrants in general without understanding a truth. And so my two questions for you, number one is, have you ever sat down and had a one-on-one conversation and just listened to an undocumented immigrant? And then secondly, in the past you've made comments about being able to just tell who an undocumented immigrant is, just kind of by looking at them or by their clothing. And I was wondering if you could, you know, comment on or clarify that.
Lisa, thank you.
Lisa, thanks, Waterloo. The answer to the first question is yes. I make it a point that I can have these conversations with people that come from all walks of life, whatever their viewpoints might be. And it goes back as far as those who were undocumented prior to 86 or beneficiaries of the 86 Amnesty Act and beyond. I've spent more than 10 years in Congress dealing with the immigration issue, hearing after hearing, and there are a few that have spent more time there, but not very many. And then the question about can you look at someone and tell if they're here illegally? I can guarantee you the Border Patrol does that every day. Law enforcement officers are trained to put together a whole series of clues. And it isn't about race. It isn't about ethnicity. It is sometimes the patterns that people have. We all have these instincts within us. So the answer to that is yes, and no legitimate law enforcement officer would take the opposite position, because they're using those signals and clues every day, not just with regard to legal or let me say illegal immigration, but with regard to what are people doing and what is the pattern of the traffic they have. They look at the kind of car that they drive, and they draw generalities, and then they turn their focus on those generalities that cause them to ask the right questions and do the right thing. So the answer is yes, law enforcement officers can. They do develop that skill, and the skill is actually taught to them, and it's exchanged among them. I grew up in a law enforcement family, and I just think that particular statement has been bandied about the Internet sites to the point where it's been distorted beyond the very clear foundational logic that is part of it.
Congressman King, Senator Harkin, with his big announcement that he has no intentions of running for another Senate term, you have said you were considering challenging Harkin even before his announced retirement, and your statement in reaction to his announced retirement was, quote, "Iowans now have a real opportunity to elect a true constitutional conservative to help lead us out of our crisis of debt and deficit." What potential candidates qualify you as true constitutional conservatives? You're including yourself. Who else?
Well, of course, I would be by now wise enough not to answer that statement directly, Ben. But, you know, the Iowans will decide that. And they have an opportunity to make that decision, and people have an opportunity to come forward and present themselves as potential candidates for this seat. You know, I can look around the room more often and see a good number of people in the room that were born after we had an open U.S. Senate seat in Iowa. So this is a rare opportunity for Iowans to select who will be their United States senator. But I think also it's important, and the reason that I put the language in there that way, to lead us out of our debt and deficit is the way I close that statement, because we are over $16.4 trillion in national debt. We have an administration that, as the president just said a few days ago, we do not have a spending problem. Well, yes, we do. And we have a big problem if that's the statement that's coming out of the White House. And I think the next election is going to be about how we get to a balanced budget amendment to our Constitution, how we overhaul our tax system so we give people real opportunity, and how America becomes, again, the land of prosperity. We will not be by increasing our debt and our deficit. And so that's, I want that to be the central issue in the upcoming campaign, whether I happen to be in that slot on the ballot, a different one, or, you know, perhaps, you know, you never know what's going to happen into the future. But I think it's very, very important that we focus on how we get to balance, how we pay down and eventually off our national debt. And I want that to be the centerpiece of this discussion, and that's why I place it that way.
Yesterday, the president meeting with law enforcement officials from communities affected by high-profile shootings. He stressed the importance of reaching consensus with you in Congress to advance his gun violence proposals, talked about restricting the access and availability of assault weapons, of these magazine clips with many rounds in them, also universal background checks. What, if any, of these proposals of the president could you support to lessen gun violence?
Well, you know, does it lessen gun violence? I'd like to see their data that would indicate that's the case. Now, at a quick snapshot, you might think, how are fewer guns and clips with less ammunition in them not going to lessen gun violence? Because it lessens a person's ability to defend themselves. And I think it was pretty clear when New York passed legislation that they would reduce the number of bullets in a clip down to 7. They inadvertently included their law enforcement officers, who said right away, well, why are we disadvantaged against the criminals? Great point. And why is a law-abiding citizen disadvantaged against the criminals, too, by the same logic? So it's, I would ask them, the advocates for this, tell me how this would save or would have saved any of those children at that terrible tragedy at Sandy Hook. At this point, no one has made that case. It is people that were always determined that they wanted to go in and reduce the number and eventually eliminate the guns in the hands of people. And it is a constitutional right that we have. They have to make a very powerful case. And so far, I have not heard that case. I'm always open to having that discussion. But in the end, we have a constitutional right to keep and bear arms. And it is about, and everyone in this country has that opportunity to hunt, to target, shoot, self-defense, mm-hmm. collect.
But broader than that,
it's about defense against potential tyranny.
Yeah, but some would say, even though it's enshrined in our Constitution, which we should respect, as is the freedom of speech, you can't, if there is no fire in a theater, stand up and yell fire. So shouldn't there constitutionally be an ability to have some restrictions, for instance, on assault weapons, and keep in terms, constitutional terms?
Well, if you accept the term assault weapons, which we know is something that a hunting rifle that looks scary to certain people, that's the definition of assault weapon. And you could go deeper into the details of that, but that really is the bottom line. And the data that I've seen come out since Sandy Hook is something between 2-3% of the violent gun crime could be identified back to the type of weapons that are termed as assault weapons. And even those are illegal, the statistically legal assault weapons used in violent crime is down statistically near zero. So why would we target that particular kind of weapon when the president himself within the last several months has said they're not shooting each other with rifles and assault weapons in Chicago, they're shooting each other with handguns. And the perpetrator at Sandy Hook, as near as I understand this, and that information hasn't been very clear, did use handguns as well. I'm not suggesting we take them away from people, but this is a particular target of anti-gun people that isn't supported by statistics or data. And I think it's important for us to understand that and have an open discussion about this. But in the end, people have a constitutional right. If you're going to take it away, you better make a very strong case for that and be able to defend it in court, just as if they were going to say, shut down this radio station on their rights and the wrong things get said. And, you know, we wouldn't do that. I'd defend your right to free speech and mine with probably even greater vigor, Ben.
So what would be your remedy for lessening gun violence in this country?
Well, while we always want to reduce and eliminate violence if we can, And the components of this go beyond the guns. I mean, even the weapon that he likely used at Sandy Hook, or one of the weapons he used at Sandy Hook, was illegal in his hands. And so we also have to understand that there has been a significant influence of mind-altering drugs and people that are under that kind of treatment. That hasn't been explored in an open media dialogue since Sandy Hook. We also know that violent video games have captured a generation. We don't know the effect of that. I don't know of any of these mass murderers that didn't have some experience with that. And the desensitization that takes place with violence that's there in our movies, I'm not in our videos across the board. I'm not advocating that we outlaw those things, but I think put that on the table for discussion too. If we're going to try to figure out how we're going to reduce or eliminate the incidence of mass murder, which statistically, by the way, are low, then we should look at the whole picture and try to understand. I'd say to Lisa, if she's still listening, we probably need to take a look at trying to profile mass murders so we can see a pattern there. And if there's a pattern there that we can interrupt, we should do that.
Republicans gathering in Charlotte, North Carolina this past weekend, at the end of last week into the weekend, Congressman King, for the Republicans' winter meeting, the committee's meeting, debating how best to bounce back from this past election, where you in the House lost seats, in the Senate, GOP losing seats, and of course the White House lost for the second time in a row. What is your remedy for the GOP? Changing policies, or is this a matter of message?
Well, the message is perhaps part of it, and there's, I think, a strong argument, which I agree with, that the tone of the message can be modified and take some of the edge off. That's good. We need to talk more about opportunity. I don't think that we were confident enough and bold enough talking about opportunity. Republicans get a little nerdy about policy, and they think that the rest of the populace is like that. But while we're sitting around in our circles trying to figure out how to produce the best policy, there are emotional decisions being made by voters that a lot of times can't be reversed by a policy decision because people are already bought in. So I'm going to suggest this, though, that there's two ways of looking at the world. And one of them is that if you grow government and continue to grow government every time that you run into some kind of an identified issue or problem, you're going to end up with government owning and running everything and dictating, you know, many, if not all, the aspects of our lives. The Republican message needs to be, we're here as a free people with God-given liberty and constitutional rights that come from God. And our founding fathers said all of what I have said and plenty more. And the vigor of America is tied to, one, legal immigration, where we get the dreamers in the world, the can-do people in the world, the energized people come here. And to exercise their liberty and their freedom and their free enterprise and their property rights, constitutional rights. And we need to unleash all of them and let America grow and prosper and be the nation that was envisioned and take ourselves to the next level of our destiny beyond Ronald Reagan's shining city on the hill. That's the message. And we can do all of that. We need to be able to sing from the same hymnal and do that. And I'm hopeful that some of what I've said will have emerged down there and be part of the national dialogue.
Do you see the sequester, the coming cuts, automatic cuts that could come into effect here, I believe, on March 1st, as the biggest point of leverage for Republicans to extract the cuts that they want in the budget?
You know, I don't. The sequester looks like now it'll be a separate debate from the continuing resolution, which expires in March 27th, and then we'll have another debt ceiling debate sometime in May. And I actually think that the sequestration debate will go on. Anything that we succeed in there will be in the margins, in my view. Then we've got the continuing resolution, again, about the same thing that I would identify. The third piece of this will be the debt ceiling debate in May that I think that will build up to that point where we're just going to have this, we'll have this continuing national debate. It will come to the point, hopefully in May, where the American people will have weighed in about what we're going to do about debt and deficit and to how to get that under control. If the American people stand with us, then I think we'll have the maximum leverage on the debt ceiling debate in May. And that's how I envision it. But if it comes to pass in a more favorable way, I'm all for that, Ben.
Less than a minute, but perhaps you had a legislative priority you wanted to mention that hasn't been mentioned in our brief discussion.
Well, I would, and it's a bill that I've carefully worked through for a number of years that I think has a chance to succeed up front now, and that is the New IDEA Act. As immigration was part of our discussion, the New IDEA Act is the new, and the acronym IDEA stands for the Illegal Deduction Elimination Act. What it does is it will reduce and eventually eliminate the hiring of people who can't legally work in America, and it does so by bringing the IRS into the equation. It gives the employer safe harbor if he uses E-Verify, but meanwhile, the IRS can then come back behind that and rule that the wages and benefits you deducted as business expenses are not deductible because you knowingly and willfully hired people that couldn't work in America legally. That adds to the enforcement of this and shuts down the jobs magnet, and that helps get us closer to the end, which is being able to have an immigration policy that absolves all of these issues. So I hope it's part of it, the New IDEA Act, and I can't give you a bill number right now, but we'll get it out on the website soon.
Congressman Steve King, thank you for joining us. Steve King of Iowa's 4th District, we appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on, Ben. I appreciate it.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.